There are plenty of things the 140 million people of Nigeria need. Decent roads, a working railway system, clean water, consistent power supply. But here's a question. Do they need a space program?
Launch command now.
Yes, it is Nigerian, and it is rocket science. The country now has two satellites in orbit, and it's not the only African nation in space. South Africa and Algeria both have satellites too. One of the Nigerian satellites does telecoms, but the one they're really proud of is about the size and shape of a packing case. It's a remote sensing satellite, photographing the Earth and sending back information. At the Nigerian Space Agency, they're immensely excited about the results. They can research irrigation, track pollution, and even provide some information you might think they'd already know.
We're able to delineate all the settlements in Nigeria from our satellite. It will help us to plan very well, maybe transportation planning. At least you need to know the number of villages or cities or towns or hamlets you have before you can plan for them.
And this information wasn't available before?
No, it's not detailed like this. We got every settlement in Nigeria.
So now finally the Nigerian government authorities know actually where people are living?
Yes, yes.
I'm sure the Nigerian taxman is delighted. But is this really a good use for Nigeria's hard-pressed science budget? In this programme, I'll be asking what type of science Africa needs to be doing. Should its researchers focus on the immediate questions of poverty, health and economic development? Or should they be more ambitious, looking to the stars? At the Nigerian Space HQ, engineer Francis Chiesa says that satellites mean his country can do both.
It has really changed the views of many Nigerians, because when we started initially, the thought was the usual white elephant programs that you see. But after the launch, a lot of people were sensitized about what this is all about.
Because some people from outside Nigeria might think, Nigeria is a country that is developing, it's struggling with lots of issues. Does it really need a space program? They'd be astonished to hear that.
I could tell you that every country needs a space program.
No, every country needs a space program.
A space program, yeah. It's the easiest and the fastest means of solving a lot of problems internally. And it's not an ego trip. It's there to solve basic problems, which you can see.
This first satellite was built in Surrey and launched at a cost of around £10 million. Pocket money in the world of space science. The argument is that for a relatively small outlay, countries like Nigeria can take advantage of knowledge that already exists, so they can leapfrog a whole technological generation. And that's happening already. Hold on. I've got a call. It's hard to overstate the impact of mobile phones in Africa. You see them everywhere, in countries where landlines are generally expensive and, frankly, rubbish. Mobiles have utterly transformed the lives and livelihoods of millions of people. Professor Calestous Juma of Harvard University loves to talk about mobiles. He's probably the world's foremost expert in the use of technology for development, advising several African presidents.
Mobile telephony has contributed to economic revival on the continent because it also shows what technology could do. The Africans did not invent the cell phone. They used an existing technology. And I think we're going to see African leaders starting to look for analogies of the cell phone in other sectors. And that's what's going to transform the continent.
That means African governments don't need to invest in what's rather confusingly called basic science, the expensive research which tries to unearth the fundamentals of ourselves and the universe. Instead, says Professor Juma, they can adopt, adapt and improve.
Africa is blessed because it can inherit a large fund of knowledge that is publicly available today worldwide. And therefore, the key question is how to tap that knowledge and transform it into goods and services. Africa does not need, for most of its requirements, does not need to reinvent what has already been developed elsewhere.
So those countries who think, well, we must set up very expensive, innovative programs in Africa, they don't actually need to do that. They should focus on what's out there and make the best use of it.
Yeah, they should be building engineering schools, because knowing and understanding what's out there requires technical skills. And so investing in engineering education will do more for Africa than building a lot of new labs. Of course, they need some labs to be able to adapt existing technology, local conditions. But I think the focus should be on building up the technical competence in the population.
Yes, watch out for this.
Okay. Oh, yes, there's a line of incredible line of ants just across the path. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
On this experimental farm near Ibadan in Nigeria, there are more than a few hazards. They're crossing a rather rickety bridge, just with some planks over a ditch. But it's an exciting place to visit, because you can see how scientists are changing lives. This is the kind of applied science in action which Professor Juma wants. On this farm, they're testing the results of research from the nearby International Institute of Tropical Agriculture.
I really believe in science, because without science we can't get all these things.
Local farmer Chief Tola Adepomona is resplendent in golden robes. He's excited about the results he's had planting new varieties of cassava, one of Nigeria's staple crops.
With the local ones, the highest production is about 10 or 12 tons, metric tons, per hectare.
So 12 tons per hectare?
Per hectare. But with the new varieties, it's about 35, 40 hectares.
So 3 times as much, maybe?
3 times as much.
So how much difference has this made to you as a farmer?
The difference is so large. Right now, the farmers, they are proud of being farmers. We will be having improved standard of living.
Has your standard of living improved?
Yes, personally, yes. I have 3 children in the university, and I can pay their school fees conveniently. I have my own vehicles, I can maintain my farm very well, and I live in a decent house.
Researchers' kids splash in the pool at the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture. It sits in its own campus, an oasis in the rambling chaos of the city of Ibadan. The institute is well funded by international donors, including Britain, so it can attract some of the world's top plant breeders. Well, I'm just about to meet the Director General of the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture, and I've been warned he's a trifle eccentric. 2 things I do know about him. One is that he always wears a hat in all circumstances, and the other is that he prefers to be known just by his surname. So I'm going to have to call him Hartman.
Those who know me call me Hartman. Those who don't call me Hatman, because I always wear one. And
you always wear a hat, I hear.
Even in the showers.
Hartman may be a touch eccentric, but he was brought up in poverty in Africa, and he cares passionately about the task. His team uses conventional techniques rather than genetic modification to produce their improved strains. External reviewers have said that their cassava technology alone has reached 50 to 60 million people in the region. One of their proudest achievements is introducing a natural predator parasite, which destroys a devastating cassava bug and so protects crops right across the continent.
Many of these countries were at war when we released these technologies. They don't even know it. They're working. The parasites are there attacking the bad parasites. The good guys attacking the bad guy. And nobody knows, but they're there, and it's spreading over 27 countries and working day and night. They don't have Monday to Friday jobs or 35-hour jobs like the French, etc., etc. So we are packaging technologies that are serving countries that would be devastated without it and have no mechanism to deal with it. So the absence of such would have been total devastation.
I know you have this philosophy here of research for development rather than research and development. I mean, can you tell me more about what you mean by that?
We are saying it's our responsibility. The end goal is what counts to us, to feed the poor and put some money in their pockets.
Some people would say science is a continuum. You can't just focus in this narrow way on practical problems. Otherwise, science will never advance.
That is a very legitimate question. What we are saying is we have a very special mandate. Whereas the universities used to be in before, we could sit and scratch our head and say, what if a meteorite landed here tomorrow? What we would do? You know, that's a very legitimate question, too. But we don't have that luxury. We are facing very stark realities with very harsh conditions. We have to solve it. So the way we handle that, or accept, acknowledge that fact, is saying there are others there who are generating the basic science.
Do you think that assumption, that principle, should go for most science in Africa more widely?
I'll be crucified for saying it, but the answer is yes.
It's my personal opinion that there's too much emphasis on relevance in Africa.
Professor Annalisa Williamson is one of the leaders of perhaps the biggest and most sophisticated research projects in the continent. It's also one of the most important. At her lab in Cape Town, she's searching for a vaccine for HIV. She understands why so many people believe that science in Africa needs to be cheap and practical. But she argues that this can only provide short-term solutions.
Everything is seen to be applied, have to have a product, have to make a difference, and I think that's the wrong way to do science. We find it quite easy to get the applied funding, but to do basic blue sky research, we don't get that money very easily.
And why is that?
Because most of the big money goes into biotech and making products, where the government want to see a company at the end of it. They want to try and encourage industry. There's a lack of understanding that if you train people on those types of projects, you're not training them to think. So in order to have an innovative scientist who's going to come up with novel ideas for your biotech industry, they have to do their PhDs on subjects where they can explore and develop their brain.
So who's right? Calestous Juma, who says Africa should invest in engineers and adapt Western technology, or Annalisa Williamson, who wants the continent to do its own basic research? Well, maybe they both are. Rob Adam played a key role in drawing up South Africa's science and technology policy under Nelson Mandela. He says we should look at the ends and then the means.
You know, I always used to argue that you may actually have to go very high tech to find a relevant technology to combat poverty or the effects of poverty. You may, for example, have to find a nanotech drug delivery system for an HIV/AIDS cocktail, so that instead of having some poor person having to juggle handfuls of pills every morning, you have one pill which is a kind of a slow release, very, very high tech, but it helps a poor person. So what you had to kind of get past there was that this assumption that people make is that, you know, to be relevant, it has to be low tech. It's a fallacy.
When it comes down to getting the biggest bang for the buck, Africa perhaps should simply focus on adapting other people's technology to its own needs. And heaven knows there's little enough money even for that. But if the continent wants to train a new generation of scientists, it will need to be even more ambitious. And maybe Africa has its own advantages too. In the rest of this programme, I'm going to be looking at two areas where the continent can potentially exploit its own assets in the global scientific arena. And they both raise fascinating questions about attitudes to science in an African context.
It's a really busy Saturday shopping morning in the middle of Cape Town, and here, right next to the Woolworths and the Hungry Lion fast food restaurant, is a sign saying Natural Herbal Medicine Centre, Professor Buma and Dr. Rose, traditional healers for all diseases and problems. So I'm going to go up to the second floor and see what they do.
South Africa probably has the best health system in the continent. Even so, perhaps 8 out of 10 South Africans use traditional healers, and they work even in the middle of big cities, prescribing their remedies, or muti. Professor Buma had brought his brand of muti from his native Uganda.
I've come into Professor Buma's consulting room, which, although we're two floors up in this quite modern building, it's full of herbs. At one end, it's been made to look like a hut. There's an animal skin on the wall. There are reeds around us, and it feels like a reed roof around us. We could be out in the bush.
Yeah, I'm Buma. I'm here healing people. I started this thing with my grandfather.
What sort of diseases, what sort of problems do you treat?
Mostly, you see, people have got a lot of complications in their body, in the system. Go to hospitals and they fail.
People come to you, they've been to a Western hospital and it doesn't work.
Yeah, but there is a way how we consult our things in our local culture way. And we come to find out what's the problem, using our ancestors and our powers we have.
So tell me about the kind of remedies you have here. I can see in front of us on the floor there's a whole array of jars and bottles and tubs. They all have writing across them. Yes. Also, there's an incense burner here. Interestingly, a Rubik's Cube as well. What are the sort of powerful remedies you use? Where do these come from?
I always order these things from my country, because they have a lot of trees, a lot of forests, and different types of muti trees and plants, or which our grand and grands have been using to heal themselves, even to stay longer.
Skeptics would say these are mainly placebo effects, which is hard to disprove as people who don't believe in traditional healers generally don't go to their clinics. But here's a story of how one skeptic changed his mind. Back in the 1960s, Charles Wambebe contracted a bad bout of hepatitis just before he started his medical training.
I thought I was going to die, actually. I called my mom to come and see me before I died. So one day, the young man who was living with me took me to a traditional health practitioner. And the man gave me some herbal extract to take. But that time before then, I used to have a very acute stomach pain, very painful experience. So immediately I took that medicine, it disappeared. And I knew it wasn't psychological because as a young science person, I didn't believe in all this traditional medicine at all.
You know, so you were a skeptic?
Very, very skeptical.
3 days later, he says he was cured. He went on to study pharmacy and has now developed a drug based on traditional medicine to block the development of sickle cell anemia. It's apparently had positive results in early trials in Nigeria, and it's awaiting full-scale trials before being licensed in Europe and the US. Certainly, many modern medicines have been developed from traditional remedies. The anti-malarial drug artemisinin, for example, was derived from a Chinese herbal cure. So can Africa do the same? In a smart cafe on the Cape Town waterfront, I meet Gilbert Matsabisa. He's running a government program to assess traditional cures. The key question is whether the undoubted potential of these herbal remedies can be used in drugs that meet conventional scientific standards. Dr. Matsabisa says the problem is a clash of worldviews.
Because science will say this is paracetamol. I don't know how paracetamol works anyway, but I know it is paracetamol. Traditional medicines will say this is a mixture of plants. I don't know what the molecules inside there are, or I don't even know what the plants are, but at least I know that this works. That's the difference.
So in other words, the traditional Western approach has been reductive, looking at the smallest possible active ingredient.
That's correct, you know, and that brings its own problems, problems of toxicity. We're also beginning to realize that the molecules in traditional medicines or in plants do in fact work synergistically. So it is the total effect of those molecules that are actually bringing out that health benefit.
But when you try and validate these drugs, surely Western doctors would say the idea of people self-reporting miraculous cures is meaningless. That's anecdotal evidence. The only real evidence that counts is double-blind clinical trials, very large scale, very carefully regulated, and anything else doesn't really tell you whether something works or not.
There are different methods, you know, of doing scientific research. One of them is what you have just described. The other method would be looking at and observing what is happening, you know, over years. And that's where science began. The difficulty would be if you were to take one single plant and go through the reductionist way to find a single molecule. And at the end, you find a single molecule and it is toxic. You cannot then interpret that as a result of a traditional medicine because you are looking at a component of a medicinal plant. There's a difference. There is a traditional medicine, which is exactly what is being used out there, and that's what we need to report on.
One way or another, these remedies will have to prove themselves to internationally recognized standards. And that means playing by the rules set down by the developed world. In her lab in Johannesburg, Professor Valerie Mitzrahi is researching TB, which may be her country's biggest killer. Despite the strong political push behind traditional remedies, she's cautious about any calls to judge them by different standards to conventional medicine.
What concerns me is when people refer to these kinds of approaches as southern science, as opposed to northern science. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with that term, but I find it hugely insulting. I mean, there's good science and there's bad science. To say that southern science has got different ways of doing things, great. If it's good science, call it good science. But I think that it's insulting to traditional scientists to argue that they're closed to new ideas. If someone comes with a great new protocol that could assess something complicated, great. Unfortunately, those kinds of arguments might ring as being very incredible in the ears of traditional scientists, being excuse-making. Maybe it's the complete lack of understanding of these two domains, like science and religion in a way. They just don't speak the same kind of language, and it's time to work systematically at breaking down those barriers.
And even if the barriers are broken and drugs are developed, there's still a big issue. Who owns the knowledge? The scientists who produce the drugs or the traditional healers who used it for generations? Related questions of ownership and tradition are also crucial to another area where Africa can excel. It's one of the most high-tech forms of science, but this is still Africa.
There used to be leopards in this area, but nobody's seen any for quite some time.
That should be a relief.
Yes, that is a relief. We did, however, we had some students here recently, and in the middle of the night, they found a cobra in the control room, Mozambican spitting cobra. But that's a very rare occurrence.
Sarah Buchner shows me round the Hart-Rayo radio telescope in the countryside west of Johannesburg. It was built by NASA in the 1960s, and they've kept the classic Joe 90-style control room with its Bakelite dials. Now, the dish is heavily used by South African astronomers.
If you look out the window, you can see the telescope's just driving to a new source.
It's quite a thing to see.
It is. I never get tired of watching it move.
South Africa's vying with Australia for a gargantuan prize, the chance to build the Square Kilometre Array. This would be the largest radio telescope in the world, and the South Africans argue that they have a big advantage. Plenty of space in the Karoo Desert, with not much going on. Which was exactly why NASA installed the Hart-Rayo dish in South Africa back in the 1960s.
As the city creeps closer to here, so we do get interference from satellite transmissions, from microwave ovens, which is why they're banned inside the valley. And we do need a quieter area for things like the SKA, which is why they're thinking of
starting... The Square Kilometre Array,
which is why they want to put it in the Karoo, where there's even less interference than here.
And the Karoo is really right out in the desert.
Yes, that is really the middle of nowhere.
So that's what you need for radio astronomy, is just nothing.
Yes, just nothing, because you want to be listening to the radio signals that come from space, which are very, very small. So we don't want to be listening to people's microwave ovens and TV transmissions.
So the Square Kilometre Array, I mean, there's a lot of talk about this, a lot of buzz about this in the scientific community here. So this is a huge project, as I understand it.
It's always hard to comprehend how big it is. This telescope is tiny, 26 metres in diameter, so it's got an area of about 500 square metres, whereas the Square Kilometre Array would have an area of a square kilometre. That's a kilometre by a kilometre, or a million square metres. And it will be able to pick up very, very faint signals from soon after the Big Bang, and pretty much able to answer a lot of the really big questions that we've got.
The South African government believes that the Square Kilometre Array will bring benefits in training a generation of astronomers and engineers. But there may be other advantages to astronomy. There's a suburb of Cape Town, which has hosted an observatory for so long that it's now called, well, observatory. Astronomer Tebe Madupe showed me its pride and joy, an optical telescope from the Edwardian era, in a purpose-built dome.
With the current setup, you would have to raise the floor so that you can reach the telescope. This is how you would do it. So move a bit from the floor. You can move it up like this.
So you started the hydraulics working, and it's very, very bizarre. The whole floor is going up, the whole circular floor. And we're now about 10 feet up above the end doorway that we came in, and coming up to the eyepiece level of the telescope.
Dr. Madupe's own story is fascinating. He's probably the first black South African to get a PhD in astronomy. He was brought up in a township under apartheid, where as a schoolboy, he built himself a cardboard telescope.
I remember the first evening I pointed my telescope to the moon. It was chilly, but it was just unbelievable. I mean, seeing those mountains and craters and things like that on the moon, it was just mind-blowing and an experience, you know, that really, I think, changed me, because after that, I just fell in love with astronomy.
Tell me about your interest in traditional African cosmology.
My interest in the African cultural astronomy has to do with the education system that we had. You know, African children go through an education system, and the education does not involve them. I mean, in other words, I didn't see myself in the books that I was reading. They would be talking about Galileo, about Newton, about people like that, people who are Europeans. And it's no wonder that many of young people do not see science as belonging to them, because the images And the way that science is sold to us, it is sold as a Western European activity and something that doesn't really belong to us, you know. And so I couldn't believe that our people, I mean, were never interested in science, or some of them never participated in science. I just couldn't believe that before white people came to Africa, Africans were sitting on trees and not doing anything.
He started to research African cosmology and was then asked to present a TV documentary on the subject. He travelled across the continent finding evidence of ancient and sophisticated understanding of the stars. His most memorable times were spent with the Dogon people of Mali.
One evening I spent an evening with an old man from the village, and I asked him which stars were the most important to him, and he told me that they were the Pleiades. So I started trying to see how much he really knows about the Pleiades. So I asked him about the position of the Pleiades at different times of the morning and different times of the year and things like that, and he gave me answers. And I went back to my laptop and I checked his answers again, I mean software, you know, astronomy software that I had in my laptop, and he was dead correct. He was perfect, perfectly correct. So clearly, I mean, stars were really important, are important in the society.
So you obviously think it's very important that students here understand science in an African context. But surely many scientists will say, well, if it wasn't for the basically European enlightenment, the age of rationality, contemporary science wouldn't have happened, and to try and present otherwise is actually distorting history.
I'm not trying to say that Africans were inventors of science or that Africans did science any better than anyone in the world. What I was just trying to show that it is a fallacy to say that Africans were never involved in science or were never interested in science. And really, to me, the most humbling and important lesson of the whole trip across Africa was that indeed science belongs to all of us, because every community on Earth has had to rely on stars for their survival. Whether you're in Asia, in America, in Europe or in Africa, it was the same. So to say that one group of people or one race of people dominates knowledge or is better in doing science than any other group, it's not productive in the sense that, you know, some people internalize that kind of nonsense and they start to believe that science doesn't belong to them. And the message for my trip was that science belongs to all of humanity.
Africa Lab was produced and presented by Hugh Levinson. The editor is Nicola Merrick.